the more that we keep doing what we're doing in regards to, like I said, you know, bringing everyone together in a way that they actually feel like this, this is, you know, because again, I think the future does belong to us. I do.
Well, and now we're going to get to have this whole good trip to the past. And I actually have ever.
How did we get here?
This is a very exciting thing for me because for like the past 25 hours, not continuously, but I have been listening to our next guest because I do Audible. So I've been listening to this like private lecture from him, which has been really cool. And I've had this thought that I think people need to get rehistory certified like every 10 years. It's really this thing. Like, I mean, I think Zinn should be required reading in high school. And but even with that, there's so many little things here and there. And I really loved this. It was very cool. I tried to share it with you, but I couldn't. It won't let me do an Audible. I can't figure out how to do it. So it is what it is. But I'll loan you my tablet and you could listen sometime.
Well, that would be fine. And obviously, I think bringing Danny on right now, it couldn't have come at a better time, honestly, because
I'm going to ask you, know, I want you to try to pronounce his last name because I think I can, but I want to see if you can do it.
Scherzen.
He's going to come on, bring him on. I'm going to ask because I've been sort of working that.
All right, Danny, I've mangled your name, or did Jen mangle your name? Who said it right? Who didn't say it right? Let us know.
Well, you guys were way closer than my kindergarten teacher and pretty much everybody since. The J is like kind of silent. It's usually Jerson or Sojerson. Shorson is how my family pronounces it, but like I think that's like a New Yorkified version of the Norwegian. So that's how we say it. The J is basically silent. But I answer any conglomeration of consonants.
Thank you so much for coming on. I saw you talking to RJ Eskow, also a friend. And so then I did the Audible and I finished. And I got to say, you know, I'm really good up until the things that happened in my lifetime. And then I feel like, yeah, I didn't like it so much the first time. I kind of I don't want to be reminded of Bill Clinton. But this is so important. And this concept that I feel like you really are really working toward is that how we keep redoing the same things over and over and over and not learning from our mistakes. And I love the way you broke it down into eras, because I think that that helps people understand. So this is sort of like the three main eras of imperialism that you talked about. And I just, you know, I guess we could start with that, like just sort of break it down, like what this is really focusing on. I mean, obviously we can't go through all of it. It's extremely vast, people. You should get it. Look, I'm going to hold it up because I'm an Audible person. So this is, I don't have real books, but, and I really only like it when it's the author reading it because then it's like a private lecture. But if you would talk about that, like the general, like, I guess, time frame, if you will, break like of imperialism, how that works.
Well, I mean, first of all, thanks for having me on and talking about this. Why write another history of the United States? I mean, there's been a million. You mentioned Howard Zinn. You know, this book doesn't try to do Howard Zinn over. You know, I mean, Howard Zinn, what his amazing accomplishment was like flipping, like inverting the way history is told.
Yeah.
So it's history from the bottom up. It's a masterpiece, Zinn's book, but
yeah.
You know, in the process of doing that, what was lost and purposefully lost was the standard like narrative, like the standard sequence. And I had this idea, right, which is probably like a wildly self-righteous ambition, that to sort of maintain the periodization that people are familiar with, but then make it confusing and a bit strange. And so, you know, Zinn up sort of the standard sequence.
I thought it was great. And I actually think that it reminded me a little bit of Zinn in a lot of ways, but it had a much more pragmatic in terms of how, like being able to connect what was happening then with what we're still doing now. Like there was, I really felt like it was, his book is a lot more, like you said, it's like a theoretical masterpiece, there's this whole thing, like a whole series of things. And this is much more practical, I think. Like I really saw it as much more like dealing with the day-to-day stuff of these administrations. And some of it was surprising. And none of it is good. And so that's my next question for you is, at what point in history Have there ever been somebody in that position in the executive branch? I mean, that's predominantly what this kind of really focuses on, that was doing the right thing. Because I was a holdout for Carter for years, and then Margaret Kimberly shot that to shit when we had her on. So, you know, I'm a loss. Anything that stands out as positive?
Well, I mean, part of the idea of the book was to highlight, you know, obviously I'm going to poke holes in some of the standard narratives and take shots at some of the myths. I mean, American exceptionalism is the target in many ways. You know, I mean, I see American exceptionalism as sort of like a disease. If a person says they're exceptional, then we give them like a diagnosis and maybe a straitjacket. If a country says that they're exceptional, then I guess that's just American patriotism, right? But one of the things we're trying to highlight is that there's these dissenting voices. Sometimes they're like labor activists or, you know, kind of like street activist people, anti-war people, but sometimes they're prominent folks. And so, you know, I think that some of the people that stand out that are not perfect, but have their moment in the sun in the executive branch are John Quincy Adams, you know, an imperfect president, but who, you know, makes certain moves against slavery and then goes into the House of Representatives, this big anti-war guy. I tell stories about Abraham Lincoln, the anti-war activist who starts his career in Congress as an anti-war activist. And it's funny because we don't teach that, do we, right? Like, right, most Americans don't learn. You know, the Mexican-American War is our first regime change war. I mean, it makes Libya, and it's like Libya and Iraq, but almost worse. I mean, it's so overt. And who knew that a bunch of ex and future presidents build their careers as anti-war dissenters publicly against that war? Abraham Lincoln, John Quincy Adams, Henry Clay, who runs for president. He's like the Hillary Clinton of his time, right? He runs for president a million times. So I'm trying to highlight some of these stories. Oftentimes the president's best moment isn't what we remember him for.
Okay. So someone's saying they want to hear the three eras. So yeah, we got off track. Sometimes I do. I'm sorry. So would you go through that? Because it really, the point of this book is really about imperialism. That's really what, I mean, that's sort of like the string theme through it. So if you would talk about that.
You know, I taught this at West Point to future imperialists. I mean, you know, to future cadets who are going to go live out the foreign policy of the United States. So it felt obscene not to say this. I guess one of my main arguments is the United States was once, always, ever, and still an empire. That is a challenge to the normal narrative, which says either, no, we're not an empire at all because we were formed in opposition to an empire, or we kind of became an empire for a little bit when we like took over the Philippines, but that only lasted a while. I argue that, in fact, we've always been an empire even before we become, you know, the American Republic or colonists. Phase one is settler colonial imperialism. Displace the natives, use the, you know, not contract, but racialize slave labor to build the country.
And this conquer. Is what era? What time frame are we in when you're talking like this first time?
So settler colonial empire, I'm talking, you know, 1607, first permanent settlement at Jamestown through about 1897. And we don't think of that as empire, even though the founders used the word. Thomas Jefferson said, we're going to be an empire of liberty, right? And all of these things. George Washington used the word empire. This is conquering Mexico. This is conquering Native American lands. This is buying and selling and stealing. In 1898, we've reached the coast, right? The continental United States is conquered and it's being settled. And now we go overseas and we do what the Europeans do. And this is kind of phase two when we go maritime, and it looks kind of like European empire. This is like 1898 till about World War II. This is Spanish-American War, seize the Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico. Many of these places are still territories.
Colonies? They're still colonies because we're still colonizing? Yes.
They don't vote for president, but they pay taxes and can be drafted in the army. And they actually, so you know, the top recruiting stations for a long time, some of the top few recruiting stations across the entire United States and territories are in like Guam, you know, and territories like this that can vote for president. So that's pretty overt imperialism. That's what Americans think of as European imperialism. And then I argue that since World War II, this is the hegemonic imperialism of bases, expeditionary and economic. We are the only country in history to put 800 bases in 80 countries. And to, you know, we're waging war at Roman Empire levels right now. We just don't think of it that way. Meaning that across the boundaries of that empire bases, American soldiers are either actively killing, advising killing, or our tech savvy or proxy forces are. And this really goes from Morocco, you know, West Africa to Central Asia at the very least. The point is, I'm trying to say that there's a long thread of American imperialism. And just because it doesn't always look like what we imagine the British doing in India doesn't mean it's not true. One last point on that. The first phase of American empire, where we go from one coast to the other, settler colonizing, looks a lot like what Russia did. They just went in the opposite direction. I can't help but wonder if we're like so similar that we can't get along like two siblings.
Yeah. I mean, you know, none of this was surprising to me. I mean, over the past 20 years, I'd say I've gotten an earful on stuff that undid all the, it's like we learn lore and mythology in school. And I'm hopeful that that is somewhat changing. I do know teachers that it's not the same. They don't learn the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria anymore. I think they are learning a little bit better. But I'm almost watching it in live time. I'm wondering if you notice this, like when we whitewash the news, when we don't cover certain things, when we censor people, all of those things is what's creating the wrong narrative that 100 years from now, those people won't have an accurate accounting. So I really see this big connection between like the history, teaching it accurately, and censorship and a lot of the issues that we're having now. I mean, do you think of that as well?
You know, there's like the cliche that, you know, journalism is the first draft of history. There's some truth in that, but and this has always been the case, but there's a lot of problems with it now. When that first draft of history is suppressed or, you know, kind of altered, or it's run by sort of a corporate media that only tells certain stories and focuses here or there, which is a discipline unto itself. You don't always have to put writers in jail to suppress them. You just don't let them on your show or publish them. That's particularly problematic. This book, as you mentioned, does have an eye to the present. It's not some academic exercise. I mean, the idea is to bridge public and private history. I mentioned present events, even in chapters from like the 16 and 1700s. It has an eye on that. One of the things that struck me about my cadets, and I saw this in Iraq and Afghanistan, is their sense of modern history, even things that happened in their parents' lifetime or their own, is very much absent backstory, context, and contrast. And so I tried to just back up and link some of these things together. But we've seen what happens when we don't pay attention to our history, either of our own country or the places that we're going to go invade, because, you know, the Iraq War, for example, has a 40, 50, 60 year backstory. And yet it's put into place by a president who doesn't know the difference between Sunni and Shia Muslims.
I'm sorry, I laugh out of it. It's ludicrous.
How have we forgotten that, like, George W. Bush was like, I just want to say it. I'm like, Donald Trump was horrifying, but George W. Bush was responsible for like millions of deaths and the like generational destabilization of the Middle East.
He's a war criminal. He's a war criminal, and his entire administration should have been tried for war crimes. That's what I think.
The best headline I saw after Donald Rumsfeld died, I can't remember what, maybe it was in the Daily Beast. It was like, Donald Rumsfeld, killer of, you know, 300,000 people, dies peacefully. It was just like a perfect... perfect description.
We had Ray McGovern on last week, and we touched on that a little bit. Rumsfeld, not a favorite. So this is more just like, of throughout your what you were researching and whatever, what did you find to be the most particularly like nefarious that we've really seen in terms of like presidential actions, things that you would just think that's just off the charts? What's the worst?
I mean, this is difficult. I will say the secrecy and the lying that threads through, and just like two examples. I found that most presidential administrations They want to do two things. They want to gather more power that they're taking from Congress and therefore the people and putting it in Article 2 rather than Article 1, right? Putting it in the Oval Office. That's the first thing they want to do. And the second thing they want to do is they want to keep you in the dark. They want to keep people in the dark so they can continue to just do what they want. Because it's really messy to have to go to Congress and like deal with public opinion. Better to just do the imperialism or do the stealing of the money from the poor and redistributing it up to the top without people knowing. Two great examples of this. James K. Polk, I always go back to the Mexican-American War, literally sends the army over an internationally recognized border into Mexican territory, or what the international law considered to be Mexican territory. When American troops are attacked and killed by Mexican cavalry, he goes in front of the Congress and lies to the American people. And we know he lied because we know his correspondence that he knew it was a lie. He said American blood was spilled on American soil. And Abraham Lincoln, 2 years later, when he gets elected to Congress, his first speech ever given on the floor, after he was told, you will not get reelected if you say this, and he didn't, he said, it was a lie from front to back. And he calls out James K. Polk. Here's another one, though. Richard Nixon. Let's not let this guy off the hook, right? Before he's president, when he's president-elect, Johnson decides not to run for president again over the whole Vietnam, just madness. He's working on peace talks in Paris, and he's trying to cajole the South Vietnamese government, sounds a lot like what's going on in Afghanistan, to deal with the insurgents, like to deal with North Vietnam and the Viet Cong. And there's some progress being made. And Richard Nixon, this is essentially treason, sends Kissinger over to Paris and says, tell the South Vietnamese that if they hold out and refuse to make a deal, like crazy Nixon's coming in, they'll get a better deal with me. Subverting a peace process. And what do we know happens? 20,000 more American soldiers die in a war that could have and should have ended earlier, and then about a million more Vietnamese. And that is rank treason, lying, secrecy. And that really jumped out at me.
Yeah. So, I mean, in my mind, in recent years, I go right to Dick Cheney. I can't get out of that. But one of the things that you talked about that really struck me, and I think just because it's recent history and we all just lived through it with President Obama, is that why this was so exceptionally disappointing. It's not that he was particularly the most nefarious. It's not that he was particularly, you know, the worst. But you made this point that I thought was really true, is given his education and his background, he was so much more knowing of what he was doing than, say, W or Trump or, you know, any of these buffoons. And that almost, it makes it more of a betrayal. And yet, if you mention that to a Democrat, you're like, you're canceled. You're not allowed to say anything negative about Obama. But would you, since I think a lot of people on here, obviously, it's recent. If you would talk a little bit about what that was that he was doing in terms of constitutional violations that a constitutional lawyer would know he was doing.
So just a bit of like personal backstory, I don't think is in the book.
Yeah.
I was in Iraq and against the war in 2007. And so like when the Obama campaign is heating up, and when he was going up against Hillary Clinton, I was on the Obama train because he was really the only candidate that had spoken against the war at the time. And I hadn't, actually. Like, that was my crime, was like I kind of went along with it. But I was so desperate to end this war that was literally killing my soldiers at the time. I said, I'm going for this Obama guy. And I did my research. Then when I got back in 2008, I was stationed at Fort Knox because I was promoted to captain. And I was canvassing for the Obama campaign secretly on the weekends in southern Indiana, right? I would jump the border. So I was on, I really had a feeling for this person.
Yeah.
So there was a certain level of disappointment. The three things that most upset me about the Obama administration, all of which I think he should have known better. The two that maybe he didn't as much know better but ought to have were surging in Afghanistan, letting the generals kind of pressure him into a surge that he was like not so sure about, telling us this was the good war, the one we could win. I think in the face of evidence that it wasn't true, and Joe Biden, of course, was the one who was right. I mean, he was the most anti-Afghan war in the group. That bears noting. And I've been a critic of Biden's tenure. He was good on Afghanistan. The Libya regime change, which he admitted, and I'll give Obama that. He said, it was an SHIT show, and it was the biggest mistake of his administration to overthrow Gaddafi and cause the chaos that now is destabilized Africa. But the real one that bothered me, those did too. He's a constitutional law professor, and yet he uses the Espionage Act, which is an archaic, ludicrous absurdity from World War I, used to suppress anti-war, you know, journalists during the First World War. He uses that act to deal with like leakers and whistleblowers more times than all the presidents before him combined. And I just know that if he was in his classroom looking at himself, Ghost of Christmas Past style, he would be criticizing those very actions as, you know, extra constitutional and at the very least dubious. Yeah. And I think it set a really bad precedent, because then when Trump comes in, what does Trump do? He says, I'll one up you and I'll start actually indicting and charging publishers and taking it a step further than the Obama administration was willing. So he kind of opened the door to that. Boy, would I like to have a conversation with him and say, like, I know you know better, just admit it to me. But he's so disciplined in his, like, you know, narrative. I don't think he ever would.
Yeah. And now, thanks to, you know, the Trump, he's looking even better. You know, I mean, if you think about it, Obama is sandwiched between W and Trump. It's almost like he's just saved from that alone. It's you know, those people are so extreme in what they've done that he just sort of comes off looking like someone, you know, moderate in the middle.
I think Obama had a huge advantage because he was our first true celebrity president. I mean, you can make the argument for Reagan or Clinton, but at the end of the day, he really took advantage of corporate media basically having his back, with the exception of obviously, you know, Fox News and, you know, conservative radio. I mean, Obama had everybody, and he really couldn't do anything wrong. And that, I think, gave him a lot of cover for a lot of the wars that ultimately were started. One thing we do like to talk about, obviously, that's why we have a podcast, is to be able to look at people so that they do have a different perspective than what is being fed to them through corporate special interest television, because that's what it is. So if you could talk about the impact that corporate media ultimately has, especially when it comes to foreign policy and war, I still don't think people truly understand what an impact it has.
They don't understand what manufacturing consent really looks like.
Yeah.
Well, media manufactures consent on behalf of the manufacturers of war material, meaning the military industrial complex and the war industry. The war in Vietnam appears absurd in the rearview mirror unless you built the weapons for that war that we were involved in from 1959 to 1975. The war in Afghanistan seems utterly absurd and hopeless and what a waste unless you work for Raytheon. Of course, if you work for Raytheon, there is a very good chance that you're going to get a talking head analyst spot on either MSNBC or Fox, because war is the last, or one of the last, truly bipartisan enterprises, is it not? I mean, there are very few issues where a Republican and a Democrat who agree on nothing else will stand up and say, we can't leave Afghanistan. I mean, we have people who call themselves left-end liberal Democrats who basically are like, I don't know, we probably have to stay for this reason. And they give different reasons. The Republicans speak a little more old school imperialist. I mean, at least one of the things I like about the Republicans is they'll tell you they hate you, you know. They'll tell you, they're like, well, I don't really like these brown folks in Afghanistan. I mean, they probably need some bombing. Whereas most of the time, the Democrats will say, well, it's women's rights. We have to look tough for credibility. But you'll, you know, if you were a general and then you go through the revolving door once or twice and you go work for Raytheon, you can be Secretary of Defense. Currently, that we have that. Well, Jim Mattis also did the same thing. You could be a congressman. You could be an elite analyst on MSNBC. And you're going to give kind of hawkish views. The thing about media is it has become ever more corporatized. Now, media was always problematic. This idea that it's only been bad now and campaigns only got dirty when Donald Trump came around or when there was TV isn't exactly.
Yeah, people think that. Please correct that.
Well, I mean, in 1800, which was one of the most contested elections, John Adams versus Thomas Jefferson, the media, like, which was...
That was the first mudslinging election.
Oh, it was crazy. They said that, like, you know, Tom, you know, John
Adams.
He's
a hermaphrodite. Thomas Jefferson said that John Adams is a hermaphrodite. I remember that.
The streets will run with blood if Thomas Jefferson is president and babies will end up on pitchforks. That's literally like in newspapers, which was like the tweets of the day. This stuff was going viral. It's always been bad, but I think that one of the things that the current media has done is it's more Orwellian in a sense. I mean, it hits you 360. Your phone knows what you're doing. It touches you on both TV and then, of course, social media. It's everywhere. But I do think that on foreign policy, the mainstream media is generally in the tank for more war. one of the ways you know this, and just one anecdotal example for Afghanistan, is that the Wall Street Journal editorial page and the Washington Post's editorial board and Rachel Maddow all argued essentially that we have to continue the war in Afghanistan at one time or another. These people do not sit in the same room on any other issue or very many other issues besides war. And it raises serious questions about why. It's not just economic determinism. There's a degree of like cultural patriotism, the Democrats being afraid to look weak, but you have to follow the money on the military industrial complex to understand the American penchant for militarism. And of course it was a Republican president who today would be like a left Democrat almost, Dwight Eisenhower, who in his farewell address coins the term military industrial complex and warns us about
it. It's one of the five most important speeches a president's ever made, as far as I'm concerned. There are plenty you can draw from. You know, look, I think that the speech that Kennedy gave at the commencement in American University in June of 63 is what got him killed. I still think that's what got him killed. And when you start talking like that, it's like, yeah, we are an empire, and to deny it is just naivety. And I am kind of curious, you know, maybe it's just the privilege that a lot of suburbanite and big city liberals have when it comes to, you know, the acceptance of these, you know, of the war machine, so to speak. You know, a lot of conservatives just get caught up in the whole, you know, American exceptionalism trope, and it's a very dangerous one. But I don't know if it has the same hold that it used to have. Nevertheless, from your experience, and this is one of the biggest issues that I have, is I really cannot tolerate people who will not serve our country, stand on a front line, and be willing to die for what they believe in, think that they have the right to tell other people that you should go die for this country. I have a very big problem with that. I always have.
I think the lowest form of human behavior, as far as I can tell, is somebody who not only avoided wartime service when they had the wonderful opportunity. One thing I'll tell folks, perhaps it's obvious, is that in every single American war, they were never really turning away volunteers. They certainly weren't for the Iraq and Afghan wars. They certainly weren't for the Vietnam War. The lowest form of human behavior is the Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld behavior. And not the only ones. There are plenty of Democrats to do this, which is as many deferments as I can get. Now, Rumsfeld had served to some extent. Cheney was like seven deferments. Bush, find a way into the National Guard. But it's in the think tanks today, too, left center and right center. The lowest form of human behavior is I'm not going to serve when my number comes up. I'm certainly not going to choose to. And my kids aren't even going to consider it. I'm going to shield them in every way. And then I'm going to be the loudest chicken hawks, we call them, chicken hawk voice for war, whether on the floors of Congress, talking heads in the media, or in the Oval Office, pushing for more war. I mean, if you believe it in a war, go fight it. If you believe in a war, send your kids to it. And to me, that just seems like the simplest thing. And oh, by the way, Tim O'Brien, one of my favorite war authors of the Vietnam War, he's being called a war writer, but he said we should actually change the term war to people killing and just insert that into everything, right? And I think that we really need to reframe what this is. And my goodness, in a different time, as in World War II, there are only 30 less Harvard graduates died than West Point graduates. We're talking 300 plus. How many in the war on terror? It's a number between zero and one. And this is upsetting to me, not because I want more war. I actually want there to be no veterans, so we don't even have to have a Veterans Day anymore. It'd be great if we just like gave up that concept and talked about peace, which is a radical act, by the way, to say the word peace anymore. People think you're naive and silly. Meanwhile, it's the most rational thing. But yeah, I couldn't agree with you more about that. I get fired up about that kind of behavior, advocating for wars you wouldn't dream of serving in yourself, and you would make sure your kids were shielded from in de facto and de jure ways every time. But someone else, they should go die for your pet ideology.
And that's the interesting thing about Kennedy, you know, going back to Jack, is the fact that he did serve in the Pacific and his instinct was not to go to war. His instinct was, no, this is not the answer. I can assure you it isn't. I lived it. You know, I mean, I read, you know, his the most famous book about his assassination, why he died and why it matters. And, you know, just reading about the portion where, you know, he talks about where they talked about him floating in the Pacific and thinking that he was going to die. And, you know, you can never imagine that it would have evolved and what it evolved into. And then you think about everybody after the fact. You think about, you know, LBJ and Nixon, and then of course, you know, you do have a president who wasn't looking for a Nishi Tringerfinger and Carter, and then you get Reagan. I mean, look, it's a never ending cluster for
the military
conflict. And that's the thing that I think people really need to understand. And that's the thing that I found so disturbing, is that even though a lot of what Trump said during his presidency was BS, he was pretty consistent about saying that war is totally terrible. We don't need to go to war. There's no point in war. And I'm like, okay, well, you know what? Even if he's full of it, he is saying it to over half the country that think he's a god. And they're going to basically take it and say, yeah, war is stupid. We don't need to go to war. Yet if he was saying, we totally got to kill the people, we got to kill all those people, and his followers would have walked right over the edge right with him and said, yeah, we got to kill everybody. That's what we got to do. And so it is kind of scary.
No, but see, I think we're still doing it. We're just not killing as many of our people. We're just killing other people by drone bombing them. And therefore, there's no body bags and nobody sees it. And that's why no one in this country cares, because it's not affecting them and they don't see it. I think if we had like on the ground coverage of what was going on in places like Yemen all the time, 24/7, people living in rubble, that fearing for their lives as drones fly over, people would know. I mean, we don't cover that. That's purposefully being not covered.
Look, what changed the Vietnam War right after the Tet Offensive was showing the body bags. They showed the coffins with the American flag draped over it, and that changed everything.
Yeah.
And at that point, it became real, and they're like, oh, wow.
Well, that's the thing. I think that's why I think everybody should have to get, like, re-history certified, like, every 10 years. We should have some.
No, I mean, honestly, I'm just, look, maybe it's just because of the way that, you know, my grandfather instilled his values in me. I would implement the draft. I just would.
I would start with Congress's family. If you want to start a draft, that's fine. Then I want their kids and grandkids should need to be the first people called. And if then they're willing to do it, then that's fine by me.
Yeah, listen, Abraham Lincoln had his son serve. So as far as I'm concerned, if you really believe in what you're fighting for, and, you know, let's face it, there was a lot of justification to the Civil War. If you are that adamant that we need to be in the Middle East and trying to start a war in Syria or continue what is going on, if you believe so heavily that Russia is a mortal enemy, if China's a mortal enemy, hey, listen, you know, we keep at it, we might blow up the whole world. So it's, you know, it's only a question of, you know, who's going to get pissed off at the wrong time and then just take it way too far. But I really think the area that we need to go to, which I still think is the biggest problem that we have, is, you know, obviously the military-industrial complex from the standpoint of the weapons manufacturers. They are probably as powerful as anyone on Capitol Hill, at least in terms of foreign policy. I have a friend who was a lieutenant who served in Iraq, in Baghdad. And, you know, I remember reading about a story about how one contractor got $25 million to build a gas station in Baghdad. And I'm thinking, what's he spending? $500,000 on the gas station and pocketing the other $24.5 million? I mean, the scam that defense contractors are running on our country is something that, again, we support the troops 1,000%.
But can't we say the best way to support troops is to not send them to things that kill them for no reason? Maybe that's the best show of respect.
Yes, but there's also there is this misnomer that we have to spend, you know, $1 trillion on the military every year. Maybe we need to spend $300-350 billion. And that may be too much, but I'm using it as an example because so much of the money is basically there to enrich war profiteers.
Yeah.
Am I wrong about that, Daniel? Can you elaborate on that?
I would love to. okay, like it's hard to even know where to start in this. I mean, I'm gonna allow myself an emotive moment.
That's cool.
In Afghanistan, three of my soldiers bled to death waiting for or on a helicopter. All three of them had neither of their legs. One of them also didn't have one of their arms. Bled to death waiting to get a medevac out. None of those three soldiers, Nick Hensley, Gustavo Rios, Chaz Ray Clark, none of those three soldiers made more than $40,000 for that year. And that was with special combat pay and not paying taxes. Let's then look at the compensation for even upper or middle management at Raytheon and Lockheed and the other contractors, or even the mercenaries that got sent over there for a few $100,000 a year to guard the gas station that cost $500,000 but was $25 million in profit. That's an obscenity. that's an obscenity that doesn't get enough attention. I often say on Veterans Day, I'll write in articles, if you want to support veterans, create less of us. That's one thing. And then the last thing I think is, you know, important about the trade-offs. You said, you know, I said the last bipartisan enterprise is war. Actually, I'm wrong. One of the last bipartisan enterprises is the defense budget. And the thing about the defense budget is it's confusing to me the way the universe is. I don't particularly have a science brain. I have a little bit more of a liberal arts, social sciences brain. And to this day, fairly smart guy, I can't get my head around the concept of the fact that the universe is always expanding. I don't know about you, but I'm like, expanding to where? How is it? Like, where does it go to? And maybe that's just my ignorance. But the only other thing in American public life that feels like that is the defense budget. It's always expanding. It's never really contracting in any meaningful way. And I think that we don't talk about the opportunity costs and the trade-offs that are involved in that. We think that because there's no draft and because there's no direct war tax, that war is an abstraction. Hey, now we mostly do with drones. There's not a lot of body bags coming home.
Right.
Invisible to us. But actually, war is a kitchen table issue. And I've been trying to say this for a while to anybody who will listen. And one of the ways is all that money that's spent on defense, 50% of our discretionary budget, essentially, could be used for a whole lot of other things. Tax cuts if you're a libertarian, or in my case, maybe just a little bit of social services so we can be an actual modern society, which brings me to advertising. You know, the Department of Defense spends millions and millions of dollars getting corporate advertising consultants to tell them what slogan will get kids to put themselves in the hook for killing and dying potentially on behalf of their country. And they come up with these great slogans, Army of One. If you're a little older like me, you remember Be All That You Can Be. It even had a jingle.
Okay, I'm older than you, I assure you.
I have a pitch, everybody, and like, remember I said this, maybe it's my one gem that I'll leave behind. The Department of Defense needs a real true advertising slogan and should be this. The Pentagon, : this is why we can't have nice things. And I think it gets to that trade-offs of what the defense budget is.
Yeah, I think that's right. We talk about it all the time because whenever we talk about things like Medicare for all or rebuilding our infrastructure or increasing minimum wage or UBI, we always get that, how are you going to pay for it? And I really just started saying, we're going to get the money from the same place the military does. That's what we're going to do. We're going to get, that's going to be our source of money. And so there, because you don't ask it about that. Nobody asks how you're going to pay for that. And I just think at this point, we need to stop falling for it. We talk a lot about modern monetary theory on this show. And that the truth is we can have everything that we want to have. We really can. And the only reason we don't is because people profit from us not having everything that we can have. I find that incredibly frustrating that the military gets that. But one thing I wanted to ask you, and this is something I think about a lot with veterans who are kind of what we call woke and really kind of understand they're not just like, hoorah, go, you know, kill everybody overseas. And how do you reconcile being in the military, serving your country? And clearly, I think to me, it's a very important thing. I wish it wasn't abused and misused. How do you reconcile that with, I'm sure, a lot of peers and people that you're around that are very go red, white, and blue?
So I was not like a courageous whistleblower in the, you know, in the vein of a Daniel Ellsberg or even in a Chelsea Manning. I did begin to write publicly, published my first book and then a couple of hundred articles that were overtly anti-war while I was on active duty as a captain and then really as a major at the end of my career. This is not done traditionally. And I don't mean that to sound self-aggrandizing. It's just factually true. I mean, I went to West Point, I served in two wars. I had taught at West Point. And then, so on paper, I was kind of one of their like golden boys to a certain extent. I was, you know, on the upper, climbing path. It is a difficult thing to do because you're scared that they'll take your pension. They'll get in trouble. I was under an investigation where I could have lost my pension in retirement. Instead, they like offered me like kind of an off ramp, because they didn't want to martyr me, I think. So I was very lucky, right? I wasn't courageous in any way. But one of the main reasons it's hard, in kind of an answer to that question, is, you know, you're giving up your identity within the tribe. The military, with the draft going away, became an uber professionalized entity. We've become almost like a Praetorian Guard. I mean, less than 1% are serving on active duty. It's become a family business. It in the combat units, especially, like in the infantry and the special forces and the recon elements, like the CAV, like I was in, these are, they don't look like America. My units and this is statistically true, are disproportionately to the extreme white male from the Deep South, Mountain West, or the Rust Belt, and have a family member in the military. If you pull a black ball soldier out of an infantry unit, that's what he does. So what the problem with this is that it becomes a subculture, an identity, a tribe. We all need that. We need a sense of belonging. And so when you speak out, when you follow your conscience in any sort of public way, you're risking all that. And I'll tell you, it was emotionally trying for me. My best friend stuck with me. I will say this, among my core group of a few hundred veterans that I served with, that I was close with, that are in my phone, right, that I text,
yeah,
I would say about 40% of them, this is vague, are hardcore red, white, and blue, angry at all brown people and Muslims, and still all in. 50% of them would never talk about victory and think this was all kind of a farce, but they're pros. They're either pro soldiers or they're just like, they're out now, but they're apathetic. They're fatalistic about it. And I don't blame them. There's almost like a nihilism to it, like professional mercenary nihilism. And I say this about people I love, where it's like, I just don't have the emotional energy to speak about this. And then there's really only about 10% that will kind of advocate or speak out for peace. But I think the interesting thing about that statistic, and admittedly it's anecdotal for me, but I think it's a pretty decent sample size, is a large percentage of the veterans of the post 9/11 wars do not believe in them in any real sense. They may not have the woke language, they may not have the sophisticated analysis, but they do know this. And this applies to my soldiers who are Trump supporters, which is most of my enlisted soldiers. They have a vague sense that, like, this was stupid. And that's interesting, because when you look at the Afghanistan war, this has to be the first time in American history this is true. 73% of veterans of the Afghanistan war in a 2020 poll were for full withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was a slightly higher rate than the civilian population. So to be clear, America's warriors were more anti-war than America's civilians in the case of Afghanistan. I can't think of another historical example, and I just wrote a book on the history of the United States. Maybe someone will find it, but I can't think of one. That is a strange thing indeed, and I think it points to a really unhealthy civil-military relationship. And you brought up the draft as I think one of the important reasons that that has become the case.
Yeah.
You know, one of the issues that I have taken very strongly with our congresswoman who Jen ran against is the fact that she is as big of a war hawk as anybody you're ever going to find. You know, you do know who Jen ran against, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so, you know, Wasserman Schultz is somebody who has always had ambitions of grandeur to get to the top of the mountain, whatever the hell
she was planning on being Hillary Clinton's Secretary of State. How do you like that? How would that have gone over?
Yeah, pretty close. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, she obviously did everything that she was told. She did everything she was told to do in order to get there. You know, she kneecapped Bernie and all that stuff. And at the end of the day, you know, there are a lot of people who want to harp on that particular part of her story. But to me, her story is much more sinister, because she's one of the people at the forefront of trying to flip the regime in Venezuela. She is somebody who has advocated for war with Iran. They're basically, you know, again, one would say, well, what does a congresswoman in South Florida have to do with that? And I would just tell people that everything in politics is very easy to understand if you're willing to be open-minded and objective. Corporate special interest money is what defines our politics in the United States. And the amount of money that she has taken, in particular, from Raytheon, Honeywell, and General Dynamics, and if you don't know what they do, I advise you to look into it. This is done for a reason. And the way I put it is, she's open for business. If you're a politician who is open for business, you are going to get money from the most nefarious industries in the country, and they will have you do what they tell you to do. And she is more than willing and more than capable of doing exactly what they want. And she has, again, when we talk about war criminals, I believe she's a war criminal. Because she will advocate for people to go and die over nothing but corporate special interests. And I think we are coming to a consensus that needs to grow larger in this country, that if your representative takes money from the military-industrial complex, they need to be publicly shamed for it. They need to be called out for it all the time. because they are nothing but mouthpieces for these major corporations. Raytheon is probably the most powerful, along with Boeing and Lockheed Martin, but you can make multiple arguments for any of these major corporations that their sole interest is war profiteering. They may do some things that are beneficial to society, and that's the PR what? Work that they do. What do you
I
mean?
I don't see it. No, what do they do?
Boeing builds airplanes. Honeywell builds home appliances. My point
yes,
is...
no, okay. We have enough of those
My
things.
Point is that they would use their PR machine to basically say, oh, but we do a lot of great things. First and foremost, your objective is to make as much money as possible, and war profiteering is where it comes from. And so the more we can put this at the forefront in terms of where we stand when it comes to our politicians, if you take corporate special interest money, and especially if you take it from the military-industrial complex, everyone needs to know this, and they need to be publicly shamed for it, because they have a lot of blood on their hands, and they're going to keep having it until we have a consensus that all war is bullshit and we need to work together, regardless if you are the most hippity-dippity left supporter or you're the most right-wing Trump supporter. You have to find common interests when it comes to this signature issue. And not only that, but we could even talk about the fact that the military-industrial complex is as responsible for our carbon footprint destroying this planet and putting us at the brink when it comes to climate change. There is a lot of places we can go, but to me, that is as important as anything. That is where I hold my ire, not just for Debbie, but for anybody who serves in Congress who, let's face it, pretty much every one of them is a chicken hawk, and they would never in a million years bear arms to defend our country, or especially send one of their children off to do it for them.
It's an interesting thing. In a lot of situations, I mean, they don't really follow it, but, you know, if Mark Esper or, you know, Lloyd Austin, who both work for Raytheon. Now, Mark Esper under Trump, the Secretary of Defense, I mean, he was like a lobbyist for Raytheon. I mean, he wasn't just sitting on the board, which is already obscene, but he was like a lobbyist for years. And so technically he wouldn't totally commit to it. And like Liz Warren, like nailed him on it. It was like one of her great moments. You know, I was like, watch that stuff to fall asleep at night, cause I'm a hyper geek. Like just watching her takes down some like corporate entity is like, that's what gives me joy. But they have to like recuse themselves from, you know, any contracts that involve Raytheon. I think that policy should apply to Congress people. When the vote for the war comes up, Debbie Wasserman Schultz probably has to sit it out and say, sorry, I'm sitting this out because I profit from the war that I could potentially approve. And no one ever calls for that. So I agree with you. It's public shaming. Stand outside of their office with a sign. If they take money from Raytheon, hold up a sign that has what my like cutoff t-shirt that I got from Massachusetts Peace Action says that I wear, that's off-putting in Walmart, that says, you know, Raytheon bombs kill Yemeni children. You know, like hold that up. So public shame them. Force them to recuse themselves and say why. I mean, this is really nasty, nasty stuff. And we don't talk about it enough. You know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is a great example. Here's the deal. I often say, people say, well, why isn't there more activism in the streets? I'm like, well, part of it is because like anti-war activism, because there's no draft. People don't have skin in the game. There's another reason. There's no money in peace. There's no money. I mean, you've got people like Ben Cohen of Ben and Jerry's, who, full disclosure, like I work with, I have a, you know, a relationship with, co-founding the Eisenhower Media Network, which is an anti-war.
Half-baked is my favorite one.
Nobody asked you about ice cream.
You know, I mean, he's got hundreds of millions of dollars. The people for war have billions. And, you know, the people don't understand the difference between that amount of money, right? It's a ludicrous thing. There's no money in peace. There's no profit in peace. And so if you want to be Secretary of State, if you want to be president someday, and you're waiting in the wings in Congress, because that answers your question that you kind of posed hypothetically, like why does like a representative in Florida, you know, have such a pro-war view? It's like, well, if they're ambitious, then there's never been much political point scoring in being anti-war. Like the best thing to be is to appear to be a patriot, not have anything that the Republicans can throw like mud at you and say that you're weak on defense and all this weird, strange, like sexualized language we use. It's always like soft on communism. There's like a lot of academic writing on this, by the way. But the best thing to do is to avoid that. I mean, Hillary Clinton did the same thing. I mean, that vote for the Iraq war is a vote to be president someday. She's hedging her bet largely. And of course, there are can they know if I run for president, I'm going to need to be like financed at like high levels, and where's some of the best money come for from campaigns? Of course, it comes from the military industrial complex. This is like really important to note. It's one of the most nefarious things that's like underlying our system, and we don't talk about it a lot. Oh, by the way, why would it get into the public narrative if the same corporate media that provides much of our narrative is funded by a lot of the same folks? And if you look at what's in their portfolios, their stock portfolios, it's going to start with, it's going to rhyme with like Rockheed Rartan and Baytheon, right? And it's not just Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I was on Arnie Arnson's show. She had run for Congress up in New Hampshire, and she was talking about Jean Shaheen today, and she was like going off a bit. I love when Arnie does that. You know, Jean Shaheen, who's a
senator from New Hampshire.
Up in New Hampshire, BAE Systems is big up there. And BAE Systems make a lot of money in Afghanistan. And Jean Shaheen is like concerned about us leaving Afghanistan. And like, I just Googled real quick, and what's on her Facebook is a speech she gives not too long ago where she says, BAE Systems plays an important role in New Hampshire's economy and in support of our national defense, and she appreciates the opportunity to participate in this whatever event. This is across the board. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is one of the worst examples of it, and she's the tip of an iceberg that goes so, so deep.
Yeah, they've been doing this for a very long time, and I do think that there is an opportunity, you know, to have sort of this anti-war movement. And, you know, one of the best places to kind of wind down the conversation is to obviously bring it right back to where we are right now. You know, corporate media is going to do anything and everything in their power, because there are a lot of very rich and powerful people that want the island of Cuba back in their hands for business interests. And so right now they're trying to use the anti-communist narrative. And don't get me wrong, I don't support communism. But if you're looking at why this is happening in Cuba right now, it's happening for two reasons: the embargo and the sanctions. You want to have a conversation about communism? We can have that after you lift the sanctions and end the embargo. But corporate media is going to go all in to basically say this is an anti-communist movement within Cuba, and that's why this is happening. And why would they do that? Because they have vested interests on that island, and that's it. I wish and I hope more people could start to see that. But as you have so keenly put, that's why they're so powerful, is because corporate media is a mouthpiece for them. And that is what they're doing right now. I just hope that the more we spread this message, the more people become aware. Once you become aware, then you're like, oh yeah, I know what they're doing. I see what they're doing. It's BS. It's not what they're actually fighting for. It's that they have a vested interest, and this is what they're telling you is what they're fighting for. But if you actually read between the lines, you would see that it's more than what corporate media is telling you.
I couldn't agree more. Look, if you're really anti-communist, history will tell you that one of the best ways to get rid of communism is to let communism run its course, right? I mean, in many ways, like the totalitarian aspects of communism will eat itself, right? You know, like they'll say like, oh, the left eats its young. Well, the capital L left definitely does. I mean, not because there's not merits in like aspects of Marxist theory, but because when put in place, any like highly dogmatic ideology tends to destroy itself in an authoritarian way. In fact, one of the best ways to empower the hardliners, whether they're communists or Islamists or in the Islamic Republic of Iran, is to blockade their people, starve their children, and bomb their folks, because then people rally around the flag. So if you really want the Ayatollahs in Iran to get a little more right wing, let's do a little more max pressure Trumpism, right? Or, and I mean, the Democrats have done it too, but he was the worst. It's so counterproductive, unless you're profiting from it, right? And like I said, you know, I mean, I think I have to say this. I don't want to be the veteran guy. I don't want to be the storyteller, personalized, emotional guy. But the American soldiers who we adulate to the point of almost fetishization, right? It's gone too far, if anything. That's probably a whole other conversation, maybe for another appearance, like we could talk about. But if you love the American soldiers, remember, if we invade Cuba or Venezuela or all the different wars around the world that we've been engaged in, they're going to get killed, and they're going to kill people and come back with the trauma and the moral injury and maybe not all of their legs. One of my soldiers, Kyle Hockenberry, has only one of his limbs, right? And he's alive. They do that for like $30,000 to $50,000 a year, depending on how senior they are. And the real money is in the people who create the weapons, sell them, lobby Congress. It's a big pyramid scheme. It's a system that they're all in, and they lobby for more of it, and they don't get questioned. And so my last point on this is this. What's required, I think, and my second book was about this, Patriotic Descent, is to reframe what patriotism is. Take the narrative from the hawks. Like, listen, like, look, there are other veterans like me. It's not just me. There are lots of us, actually. The thing is, patriotism is not just being pro whatever your country is doing. True patriotism is questioning it and hoping that we get to the aspirational republic we want to be. And if we see the narrative that patriotism is militarism, that patriotism is camouflage and it is bombs, if we let them have that, then we're always going to be on the defensive in the Democratic Party, worried about right. looking weak. We're going to have a bunch of Harry Trumans, and we have to get away from that. The true patriotism is not militarism. They are not the same, and we need to just totally uncouple them. And I've been yelling about this, yeah. and maybe I will be wrong dead.
No, but one of the things you said, and this was in the very beginning, and I know you, it wasn't your quote, but dissent is not disloyalty. And I think that that is a really huge thing for people to understand. I've always felt that while I've always been dissenting. I think I've just always been in dissension. But yeah, and I've always thought, why could someone else tell me I'm not patriotic just because of, like, why does someone else get to own that narrative? And I've always thought that that's a bunch of crap. So I'm glad that you said that. But as we're wrapping up, like, if there's anything, like, Peter, what do you have to wrap with? Oh,
well, I just want to say thank you. I know it's a cliche, and I know you hear it more times than you need to hear it, because a lot of it's empty. A lot of it's just to say thank you for doing something that I didn't have the balls to do. It's quite frankly what a lot of people are saying. And that's no disrespect, but it's the truth. Because most people don't have the balls to actually defend somebody or something and die for it. Because most people are cowards. And that's an unfortunate byproduct of the world that we live in. There's a lot of jealousy and inadequacy that comes from representatives like Lindsey Graham, who never met a war that he didn't love and wouldn't want to send somebody off to die for because he's a coward and would never serve our country. And that's something that never gets talked about enough. But I do think there are a lot of people who are evolving, especially the millennial and Gen Z generations. There is this, there is this rejection of war and wanting to move away from it. Unfortunately, we don't have the levers of power, at least not yet. But I do think that we are heading in that direction. It may not be as quickly as we'd like it to be.
But we're heading in the direction of Space Force, but I wanted to just pull this question up because somebody wanted me to ask you about talking with Oliver
yes,
Stone.
And let's be honest, we would love to get Oliver Stone on our podcast.
But they want to know what you think about the new Space Force.
I think it's about as ridiculous as the Steve Carell movie of the same name. I mean, the there were treaties that said we wouldn't militarize space, like that. Yeah. You know, we signed these treaties, but we didn't really believe in them. I'll tell you this. Let's worry about Earth first. Let's demilitarize Earth before we start militarizing the solar system, because there are only two existential threats to America and the species, and neither of them is terrorism, everybody. And they are this. Nuclear catastrophes will probably be some sort of mistake and miscalculation because of saber rattling. And the second one is climate change. Both of those things, by the way, avoiding extinction and making sure that great-grandchildren is still a thing, both of those things require cooperation and just, you know, dealing with people we don't like and coexisting, which is why I think peace is not naive. Peace is the only rational way forward. And I think this, so that therefore the Space Force is ludicrous, because the idea of militarizing this while we're on the brink of extinction on our planet. And oh, by the way, all the knowledge needed to save the world from climate change and nuclear catastrophe is in your phone, in your pocket. And like, sorry to be a little bit provocative, but the problem is most of us are too busy trolling our exes on Facebook with those things to actually read about the things we need to. I'm so thankful for some of the things you guys brought up and the topics that we raised.
We could talk about something we don't really have time to do about militarization at home.
Yeah,
how it corresponds abroad.
Yeah, I think we should have a military panel at some point. I think that would definitely be a good idea. And I think
let's talk about Oliver Stone. You know, shoot me a line, and like maybe we can put together some sort of anti-war veterans like small panel.
Oh, 1,000%.
I mean,
you know, amazingly, I think he's one of the finest directors we've ever had, and I still haven't seen his magnum opus. I still have not seen Platoon, and that's my fault. Oh. You know, it's.
I know you're doing tonight, but it's not important enough not to watch Platoon. I'm just going to.
Well, that's, and I agree. I agree 1,000% because Wall Street and JFK are two of my all-time. Okay,
the more important thing is the untold history that he did, that the series, which was really great.
But Platoon is basically his autobiography of his time serving in 1968 in Vietnam. And so the importance of that story, and it was, again, it was lauded, particularly as I remember, by Siskel and Ebert, because no one had ever done a movie truly depicting. I mean, I thought First Blood and the job that Stallone did was excellent in terms
First
of
First Blood was really good. I've got to say,
post-traumatic stress disorder, but no one had actually, you know, you can make arguments. I mean, I think Apocalypse Now was a very good movie, but everyone always says that if you want to know what it really was like to be in the jungle, you have to watch Platoon, because that really cuts to the core of what really went on in terms of the genocide, in terms of the PTSD, everything that came together. And again, it's my fault. I mean, I just haven't done it. And it's not that I'm avoiding
it. I'll put it on your list.
I can handle it. Yeah, put it on the list.
I'll just one last, you know, kind of an out about veterans, like an outro maybe, you know, that you kind of threw without meaning to. At the end of Platoon, the Charlie Sheen character, who's based on Oliver Stone, is wounded and he's flying away. And Oliver Stone really was wounded. And he gives like this monologue soliloquy, and he says, "The war is over for me now, but it'll always be there for the rest of my days." ... He says, "But for those of us who did make it, we have the obligation to build again, to teach to others what we know, and to try what's left of our lives to find a goodness and a meaning in this life." And I hope that more veterans in my generation, they're starting to stand up, will be that voice. We're not the leadership, we can't run the movement, but I hope we can lend our voice and whatever credibility we have and try to find a goodness and a meaning in this world that's not militaristic.
That's awesome. That's perfect.
For your
don't
service.
Do that if you're not in the service. Stop doing stuff like
don't
that.
Salute don't salute a soldier do if that. He served. You can still do that. I may not have been a soldier, but you better believe if I was, I mean, look, I don't like rehashing the past, but it's something that, you know, It eats at me. You know, I had signed the letter for the Army after 9/11. I didn't go. You know, I've lost some friends. It's a very personal issue for me. It's not something that goes away. It just doesn't. And in retrospect, I'm glad I didn't go, because I would have been fighting for something that I thought I was fighting for, and in reality, it wasn't anything.
Correct.
To do that. And that is the message that has to be sent out. And one of the best guests, Danny, if you have an opportunity to check out our podcast, I highly recommend you check out the podcast we did with Isaiah James. He is a friend. He was on Jen Slate. He is running for Congress in New York's 9th District. He's a veteran. And he talks about the fact that I'm a veteran because I couldn't do anything else.
That was the jobs program in his poor black neighborhood.
This is what got me out of the hood.
Yeah.
I was able to go into the service. And he would admit that, you know, I was there when I almost left to go to the Middle East. So yeah, it is what it is. But like I said, it's not an easy topic to talk about.
No.
But my God, do I have fire in the belly when it comes to it, Danny? And like I said, I thank you.
Thank you for your
guts, because most people don't have it.
No, I thank you for writing this book, and I think it's important, and I think that it's the kind of thing that everybody should read. So let's put that back up. Get that back. Everybody check this out. And I always say this, I do Audible. I know it's kind of cheating. I'm like, what did I do today? Well, I'd like to say reading, but it's really just listening. But, I think it's really important, people, when it's Audible, that's nonfiction and it's done narrated by the author, it's exceptionally good. You're essentially getting a private lecture, which for me, it's the best. I really only like it for nonfiction, but I highly recommend it. Danny, thank you so much for coming on. Like, I'm very happy to meet you. And I've been listening to you for like 25 hours. So, I appreciate you coming on so much. Thank you.
Same here, brother. Well,
yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it. And without, you know, fawning over the host, let's just say this, like, there are different kinds of veterans. And, you know, Norman Mailer wrote a book called Armies of the Night about opposing the Vietnam War, marching on the Pentagon. And I really think that the work that you're doing and even bringing up these issues and advocating against them, that is going to end up being more of a service to the country than any machine gun holding soldier can be. And so this is important. And I'm so
thank
glad.
You.
Thank you
so much. Thank you. It was nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you. We'll do it again.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you, soldier. Have
Bye.
A great evening.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.